Hi, this is Kevin Eubanks.
Ta-da!
Fantastic. All right.
Well, first of all, thanks for being a great supporter of public radio. I mean, I loved your appearance on Mary McPartland's Piano Jazz several years ago.
And
Jazz Set with Dee Dee Bridgewater. And of course, you've been on shows like Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan and Tell Me More with Michelle Martin. So thanks for being a good public radio supporter.
I want to thank public radio. Really, it's just that's mutual. Believe me, man. I look forward to it.
Yeah, cool. You know? Well, first thing I wanted to ask is, you grew up studying you were in a musical family growing up in Philadelphia, right? And studying trumpet and violin. And as I understand it, it was a James Brown show that got you to kind of think about guitar. What was it at that show that you were seeing that made you want to?
I've asked myself that same question. Always. I remember it was the Uptown Theater on Broad Street in Philadelphia. James Brown played, and he was like the biggest, you know, everybody wanted to be James Brown and everything. And when I came out of that show, I remember standing by the curb waiting for my dad to come pick us up, you know, my brother. And I looked down and I said, I want to play guitar. And I have no idea what would make you think I'd want to sing and dance or something. But from that show, I always wanted to play guitar, and my parents thought I was kidding, but I just couldn't think of anything else except I want to play guitar. And it was after James Brown concert, you know. I have no idea why that made me want to play guitar, and a D7 chord, because every song. So I want to play guitar. I want to play that D7 chord. But which is not an easy thing to do. You know, to play that with that groove.
To lay it out
to
for
just keep
15
the
minutes.
Thing. And it, you know, and I didn't realize it then, but it was kind of not exactly the same thing, but you're playing that same rhythm and it's really part of the groove. It's part of it. It starts to like become a chant and it's, you know, really locks stuff together. But then when you go to Count Basie's band and, you know, he didn't even have an amp.
Yeah.
Just, you know, but that became that same type of feel that just kept coming and just kept coming, you know. So over the years, it's made me grow and grow in respect for how the rhythm guitar has a place. And I mean, guitar is an amazing instrument. It, you know, melodies, harmony. And it's a rhythm instrument. I think at some point piano was, maybe it wasn't called a piano before it all tempered keyboard and all that, but that it probably came from percussion instruments before it got into that. You know, I don't think guitar is labeled now as a percussion instrument, but it probably did to start with.
Well,
in
the way,
be surprised.
Yeah, and the way several jazz players play it, you know, it's in a you're putting out these chords to the layman's ears in an irregular manner, in a percussive manner,
right,
as part of not only a rhythm but also emphasizing what the other players are doing, buoying up the soloist at the same time. When you're putting in those chords there, you're doing it in a percussive manner,
and that's a real important aspect that the guitar, you know, has to it. Like Freddie Green doing it, or the rhythm guitar player for James Brown, it is a connecting thing. It's a rhythmic thing. It's percussive. It's all that. So after a while, I just said, well, maybe that's what struck me. Maybe the consistency of that. But that's it's as close as I can give to a reason why, you know. But I think it's amazing how guitar is in so many different genres of music and cultures everywhere. Maybe not in the Western form of it, but you go to different parts of the world, there's some instrument that, you know,
stringed instrument.
Yeah, that looks like a guitar. It's a ukulele, it's a mandolin, it's this, it's that, it's banjo, or whatever it was before it became into the form that it is now. But the percussive properties of it is, you know, very important.
Well, when you were in the Tonight Show band, there was a different format that you were playing there, a different style. How did that affect your, for lack of a better word, your normal playing, your jazz playing, you know, being in that band and having to do what you did there?
What it did, it was, in a way, it didn't do anything, because we were playing a lot of things that I played when I was 15, 16 years old. We didn't play a lot of jazz, even when we had great, great musicians in the band. But my job, the way I looked at it, was I'm here to support the show. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a stage to develop this group into a jazz late night show. That's not what I thought would be the best thing for the show. The music that I picked for the show was stuff that I'd done when I was a teenager. So that part didn't affect it in any kind of way. That was just part of what I thought the show needed. On the other hand, when we started playing with a lot of the other groups that came on, we played with Dolly Parton or Clint Black, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Solomon Burke, people like that when they came. So we would rehearse with them. I would rehearse with them. And I'd get to hang out with them. After a while, you know, Clint Black and I started hanging out. Or I'd, you know, Willie Nelson, you know, I'd hang out with Willie on his bus whenever he showed up. Or I'd go to his gigs now, which maybe I wouldn't have done before.
Did you hang out with Willie? Or?
But well, I don't think Willie trusts you on the bus unless you're...
All right.
Making me cough just talking about it. So, but then you start to know these people and you become, you know, friends or acquaintances with some of them I know to this day. And I got close with B.B. King. And after a while, that starts to change your attitude about things. That starts to, because now they're friends and you get what they're doing more and more. I mean, I've always loved blues music and things like that. But when you actually start to hang out with people that you didn't know before, and it's not just music anymore. It's your friend now, and you hang out and you meet their friends, and after a while you start to somehow understand it a little bit more. You start to go like, oh, I feel this more, and you start, you know, getting more and more, your collection starts growing of music that you listen to, and then it feels different to you because now you have a personal connection with the music. It's not just a musical connection, but, you know, BB is going to a show and he says, Kevin, you know, you're on the same festival. Ride with me in the back of, you know, so BB and I will be at the back of his tour bus and we just sit back and we'd listen to stuff and he said, oh, you should hear this or you should hear that or something like that. Or all of a sudden that changes everything. And it's not something that you change in a musical sense, but it changes you a little bit, and then that changes you in a musical sense. So in that way, it really opened up a lot of things. I got more into bluegrass music. Mm-hmm. Dolly Parton's "The Grass is Blue."
The Grass is Blue. That's a great album.
That is a great record. And I started listening to more of Dolly Parton, and then I noticed a couple songs on there that sounded more like mountain music than it did bluegrass or country music. So I started trying to find things where she sang that, and that has become my favorite Dolly Parton music is when she's singing that way.
Yeah.
It seems like this. I just feel more heart in it, you know, not anything how she's doing it. Just the way I heard it was like, wow, this really touches me a whole lot. So in that way, it changed a whole lot from being on the show because I started being not just opened intellectually about different types of music, but I started to really feel it more because I started to actually meet people and started going to their concerts, which I probably, you know, I'd go to some blues shows, but going to a bluegrass festival, I didn't do that before.
Yeah.
But when I started playing, you know, I want to meet this guy, I want to meet this person, and blah, blah, and a lap steel and a pedal steel and band, you know. And I thought the technique in some of these players would, you know, reminded me of jazz musicians. And I always thought it would be a great record to have jazz musicians and bluegrass music really play, you know, come up with music together, not play songs that they play in that genre or we play in jazz genre, but something that they came together with to play together. Because the technique is great.
Like Bela Fleck type.
Bela Fleck,
yeah.
You know. Jerry Douglas, mm-hmm. people like that, and The way the bass sounds has a different kind of rhythmic thing to it. It punches it in a different way. And you start to notice that. And a lot of it came out of that way. So in a musical sense, being on that show opened me up a lot. But it wasn't necessarily the music that we were playing. It's the association that I had with the other musicians.
Well, before we turned on the microphone, we were talking a little bit about the physicality of performance. And did being on that show, being the band leader of the Tonight Show, did that, you think, change or improve your performance? And I mean the actual stage presence and everything that you that comes along with that as well, you think?
I still get nervous before I go on, I don't know. That's a good question. I never was asked that question before. I think it's easier for me to relate to people. You know, I don't know if that comes across when I'm doing a gig or not. I'm always having the jitters, but I used to say, you know. It's more excitement than anything. I still have this edge of excitement before a play.
Yeah.
Like that. But as far as the stage presence, my stage presence is terrible. It's it's always been, because I just, you know, the music just is, I'm ready to play. And but before you know it, you know, I answer your question. I think maybe I am better at it, you know, maybe incrementally so, but I feel it's easier to talk to people in the audience if that's, you know, in a club situation. Sometimes it's just that way, you know, you're playing a show and it's raining and people come in and you don't think of anything, you know, but it just comes to your head because you're comfortable, especially if it's a club you've played a lot before. And so Smitty will be taking all your jackets and this and that. And Smitty will be, what? And, you know, but that probably wouldn't have happened before, you know, being, you know, in that kind of show, variety show and comics on and writers and all of the time, you know. So I think.
And having to riff verbally with people like that.
Yeah, yeah. It just kind of happens naturally. So maybe I am a little bit better. Some people would be like, you know, one it did happen one festival. I got on a roll and I was talking, and then somebody shouted out, play some music! I said, okay, I get it. And that, so I always, okay, you're here to play music, Kevin.
Well, you know, I'm curious about gigs and about, I've always wondered this with jazz musicians too, because you know, when you're creating your set list that you're gonna put out for the gig you're gonna play, do you feel the need to always create your set list based on whatever your most recent album is, or do you like to draw from your entire career or throw in standards, or what do you like to do when in terms of presenting a show to an audience?
Usually just go do it by ear, what feels good, what feels right to do next. And sometimes it's totally, I gave up writing set lists years ago because we never followed them. Never. You know, you might have your closer or something like that. But I never followed the set list. It just didn't matter. The funny thing is, when if I play with a different group, it's not my group, and I'm, you know, I always say, where's the set list so I know what's coming up, you know? And but then once I learn their book of music, I don't care what's coming up next. Right. So I just kind of play it by ear. If Smitty, the drummer in the group, if he's having a hot night, you can't get in his way anyhow. So just, you got it, Smitty. And I'll just come in and we jam for a while, and then maybe from there we'll segue into another song. But it really depends on what's happening. One time we played in a room that was so echoey. I mean, you just couldn't play anything even slightly loud, or it would just feedback. Mm. And it would just be a miserable, you know, time. You just couldn't hear anything. So said, Smitty, could you play Brushes all night? All we're going to play, just play Brushes all night. And we're not going to play the sound, turn the monitors off, turn all this stuff off. It was beautiful. You know, everybody could hear everything. It drew the audience in more. And that was just to deal with the fact that we're in the acoustics in the room were just terrible. But it taught us something at the same time. Somebody loved playing with the brushes. Everybody's, you know, the way we played the song, the intros to the songs were different. Everything was, you know, the way the ballads played, everything worked differently just because of that. So a lot of times, just doing it by ear, just, you know, instead of having your regimented thing set up, you just have to go with what's in the moment of what's happening, and it makes a big difference sometimes.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm curious another thing about contemporary jazz music here. In classical music, you know, we often wonder what is going to be the contemporary work that's going to stand the test of time, right? Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about that in jazz, about, you know, what are the tunes that have been written over the past 50 years, if any, that'll make it into the standard repertoire in the future? Do you ever think of that in terms of your own music at all? I mean...
Yeah, not a lot, though. But there are some songs that people use in some colleges. They, you know, the head of the department, you know, we use your, you know, could you send us that song? And we want to use that to teach with. We want to use it for the ensembles here to play, or, you know, big band writing, you know, that song would work for that. And we want to get some contemporary things to do that. But I doubt that that is very meaningful in the way that you asked, because there's no lyrics to it. And what makes some of the songs standards is the time period in which it all happened. And there's lyrics involved in it. And it was just show tune. It was this song. It was something. And it got into all different genres of music. And that because, you know, it touched so many different areas, it made it easier for it to become a standard. I don't think there's anything that you just identify completely. Well, this is, I want this to be a standard, or I want this to be a standard, or something like that. But the fact that in jazz, by and large, but certainly not across the board, of course, that the instrumental songs, I mean, if you ask a person, just the average person, what do you hear when you listen, when you hear a song? You know, what do you, because we're musicians and we think, you know, this is what we hear, and we think everybody else hears it. We were talking about, me and Doc were talking about it earlier. It's like, well, what do they hear? And I just randomly, I could be walking through a park and say, what are you listening to? And it says, well, what do you hear? And they go, oh, this is a song. I'm not, you know, who wrote it or what the song is, but what do you hear? Do you hear the piano? Do you hear the bass? And they go, the lyrics and the beat. And that's it.
Mm.
So how are you going to have a standard song if there's no lyric? People don't know how to listen to songs that don't have lyrics to. How do they associate it with growing up? Do they associate it with this, a sunny day or a rainy day, or I'm in love, I'm out of love, I'm, you know, those things everybody can relate to. I think that helps make things become a standard. But there's standard movies. There's standard types of things. You want to see the good guy win. You want to see the romance work out after having a problem and it resolves. It's a standard thing that we all deal with. So I don't really feel that the songs that I write, nor do I think about when I'm writing it, probably won't wind up as standards. They might be in an instrumental way, which is probably a lot smaller circle, that it might be in some colleges for a while and stuff like that. But, I mean, My One and Only Love as a song is a beautiful standard for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, but things have changed now. The way, you know, people hear music now and the way it's related. So, you know, I think about that when you hear music, you hear rap music, or you hear different kinds of music, you know, what would be the standard song in that, you know, and how many different areas, not to pick on rap music, or could be different kinds of music, but how is that relate in different time period? I mean, you're talking about decades and decades and decades, you know, Gershwin or something like that. it can be, but you heard it on Broadway, you heard it in songs, you heard it this, 10 different artists sing the same song. It's something that you can sing to all ages and people grow up into it. So it becomes standardized in a pervasive kind of way in your culture that you're coming up. So it's kind of a different thing, but there's probably people in the different types of genres of music that in that circle, you can have a lot of different standards, but it probably won't be, you know, I don't know.
Oh, do you think it's also, do you think it's also harder though for a song nowadays? Maybe let's take a popular song to become a standard in some sense, or to, because people so associate it with the original artist that recorded it too, mm-hmm. sometimes, because it's like, I don't know. I mean, a Bee Gees song, for example, mm-hmm. you know, like Staying Alive, right? Well, mm-hmm. you can't think of anybody else doing that song except the Bee Gees, right? And the way it sounds with the Bee Gees and the tempo that they take and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or it could be the Beatles, or it could be Public Enemy, you know? It's just, I mean, Public Enemy is a great example because the mix and the way the sound is created in their music is such that it is so unique to them that it's hard.
It's hard to repeat that kind of thing. I agree with that. I did hear, I was in Russia playing, and somebody, and this was in the where I was playing, and the music that, you know, while everybody's coming in and all that, and it was Staying Alive, and it was a funk version, and it was so badass. It was so good. It was a badass version of it. I mean, it was so good. And it's like, who is the band? You know, the song was Staying Alive, and it was a great arrangement of it. So sometimes it's almost like shows you just how great the song is, mm-hmm. that it can cross over in different genres, and it's still, you know, the essence of it is still there. I mean, it was really good, but it may not happen as often as I'd like to hear it, because there's some great songs, and I like to do arrangements on different songs like that. But part of it is, I really want to hear, you know, this person sing it. And that is the one that I measure all of them by.
Yeah.
Is that. I want to hear Marvin Gaye, what's going on. I don't want to hear somebody else sing that song.
Yeah.
You know, but he comes on, you know. And that is a great thing when just one person does it. Because a lot of the songs, you know, 20 different artists are doing this song. But I definitely agree with you. There's just some people that I just want to hear Aretha Franklin sing Respect. That's it. Yeah. I don't want to hear anybody else do it, you know?
Oh, man. Well, the last thing I want to ask before I let you go is just kind of a geeky tech question. Is I want to know kind of what kind of guitars you play. And there's something unique about them. I see photographs of them. They seem like they have kind of like wide necks on them or something like that, too. Am I wrong? Do they have kind of like a
wider necks. Yeah. And that's because I play with my fingers. So classical guitarists would do the same, would pick up my guitar and say, wow, this feels good.
Mm-hmm.
But a guitarist that's more in a traditional size neck that perhaps plays with just one pick, but in bluegrass, they might play with finger picks on each finger, something like that. But still, the space between the strings could be, you know, very brief. So because all you got to get in there is a pick. You don't get your whole finger in there. And so mine would be definitely wider down to the bridge all the way up. And I like the tone of it more because you have more meat on the neck. So you get a warmer sound if you're looking for that, if you need that. So a lot of it changes the tone of the guitar, the width of the neck and how deep it is and stuff like that, which I learned from bass players, acoustic bass players. A big part of the sound is what's coming off from the neck that feeds into the body. You know, we are getting geeky, aren't we?
I can dig. I like that.
But it you know, it's a lot more to it. And the guitars that I play now are just custom-made guitars that are made to fit me, what I need out of a guitar. And that's across the board. That has to sound great, number one. It has to feel good. I have to be able to travel with it. Or you might wind up losing it because you got to put it on baggage or something like that. And that's something that's real that you have to deal with, you know. So, but everybody has a different kind of feel. The real interesting thing is I lost a guitar a while back, and I had to because I was traveling, and I had to get to two concerts that were coming right up, and I didn't have a chance to get another one from home. I was on the other side of the country, and nobody could tell the difference. And that made me think, and nobody could tell the difference. Barely the people in the band on stage with me, you know. I was playing with Dave Holland, and you know, nobody could tell the difference. By the time the monitor person gets to it, the house gets to it, the whole thing. I mean, what are people hearing? But you're up there, and you know, we're so, oh, I got to have this, I got to have this, I got to have that. But my attitude about that has changed about that. Just give me the guitar and I'll play it.
I'll make it work.
I'll make it work, because at the end of the day, it's, do you make somebody feel something? It might feel sound great to you because it's your guitar. You could have designed a guitar yourself and just perfect for you. It has nothing to do actually with what the other person is hearing. And is it something that makes people feel good about it? I could sit in at a blues club. I don't take my guitar. I don't do anything. It just, guy hands me his guitar. It could be real slinky strings on it. I like thicker strings. But we're playing music now. We're not, you know, we're not measuring this and measuring that. Just give them something in a guitar. And if you want the low, you know, if you want that, play on the low strings. That'll make you play something different. If it's this and that, you know, at the end of the day, you listen to what Nat Cole was singing into one mic, and you know, a whole band is playing, and it's, you know, bluegrass groups, they have one mic, you know, and the fiddle player comes up and plays, and it steps back, and the vocalist comes on the same mic, and the whole thing, and it sounds great. It's just one mic. And now, they, you know, we need like 2 hours to do a sound check. And, you know what I mean? And at the end, you know, if you can't hear the person next to you playing too loud, that's it. That's the, you know, so it all works out and everybody feels it. And it's a whole different thing. I mean, you could take everything but so far, you know. But if you're not feeling anything, it really doesn't matter.
All right. You know? Cool.
Really? Really?
He's joking. What's that? Hey man, if I step on your toes, just lay out.
Just lay out.
Wow. Well, Kevin Eubanks, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous.
No, man, thank you for having me. And again, you know, just, I can't say enough for public radio. You feel like you, there's something you want to turn on where you feel you're getting a square shot. You're getting something real, and people are doing it, you know, from the, for the right reasons, and it just feels comfortable. That's how I met. I, we might run out of time.
No, no.
That's how I met Janice Ian, who I grew up listening to and loved her playing, you know, since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And this is while I was listening to Sly and the Family Stone and James Brown and everybody else, and but I always liked Janice Ian for some reason. I was listening to Neil Young. I listened to a lot of music when I was a kid, and. So I was doing a public radio interview, and I can't remember the city, and they said, well, what's in your, at the time it was iPods. So what's in your iPod? What are you listening to? And I said, I always listen to Kinda Blue, Miles Davis. It always just puts me in the right space, you know, and it's almost like listening to the ocean or something. It just, you know. And I always have a Janice Ian playlist that I always update. And they said, really? I said, yeah, you know. So interview's over, and somebody comes out and says, Janice Ian just called for you. And I never met her before. And she says, she wanted me to give you this note. And it's, and the note says, I don't believe you. And she left her email, right? And I wrote her, and she says, here's my number, call me back. And we've been friends ever since.
Oh, that's beautiful.
You know, and that's public radio. And I said, she says, I don't believe you. I said, go ahead, say a title of one of your songs. And I would start singing a lyric from it. She said, oh, you're kidding, we got to get together. And we did, and we started writing together and all that. And we're friends to this day, you know. So I don't know. Is there something about that that, to me, fit with public radio? Somehow that was a reflection of public radio to me, that it brought us together, completely disparate type of things that people would think that, oh, he's playing this and Janis is playing this or something like that, and not true. And it just came together at the right time, and that's amazing. But that's how we met, you know. So that's my favorite, you know, public radio story, but it was real. You know, it's cool.
Cool. And that's why people should support public radio, too.
Definitely support public radio. And you're not just supporting public radio. You're supporting yourself by doing that. You know, you can't do it by yourself. It's like when I go to a store that's selling good vegan food, I'll in the deli section, some of them might have, you know, you could leave a tip here, you could do this, you know. I want this store to stay open, you know. So I give a generous tip when I go into the store, you know, because I want them to be around. I'm not just helping the store. I'm helping me. I need nutrition around me. I need to write, you know. So how do I do that? If that's the way I can do it, if there's a co-op, fine, I'll do that. If I can tip enough that it makes a difference, if everybody did that or something like that. So it's by supporting public radio, you're supporting more than just a radio station. You're supporting how you feel about things. You're supporting about how you feel about the world, how you feel about different things. And you want to have a place where you feel at home. And it's not just supporting that or supporting that. And, you know, it's part of the collective that you're part of, that you're involved in. So it's like, you know, you're not just supporting your house. You're living it, you know. So it's great. And again, thank you for doing what you do and for all public radio doing that. It's a beautiful thing. We can't let it go.
Thanks, Kevin.
Sure. Yeah.